Welcome to the Vita Voices Power to Empower podcast series, where we're speaking with women leaders from around the world about their bold ideas, their courageous leadership, and their thoughts on the way forward. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Elise Nelson.
At just 24 years old, Chelsea is a two-time founder, movement starter, a force for change, and icon. Chelsea is co-founder of Freedom March NYC, a youth-led civil rights organization focused on meaningful policy change and equipping young people with the tools and community to peacefully mobilize and get their voices heard. She's also founder of Women Everywhere Believe, a nonprofit dedicated to closing the intersectional leadership gap in the civic and corporate sectors that primarily affect women of color. And in addition to being founder and public speaker, Chelsea is an expert and social impact strategist focusing on civic engagement, youth activism, gender equality, and criminal justice reform. She proves that when young women have a platform, they will indeed shake the world. Chelsea, I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to sit down and chat with you today.
Yes, so excited to be joining you. And there's so much that has happened, even as you read the bio, you know, kind of just reflecting on everything that has happened on the front lines, but also everything that's preceded that and being able to have this space to really unpack that. So very excited to be here with you today.
So Chelsea, I know that obviously you're not new to the civic engagement space, but I'd love for you to start by talking about how Freedom March NYC came together. As I understand it, you and friends were texting back and forth following George Floyd's murder to find a protest, find a place where you could go and add your voice. And it evolved into a massive, massive gathering. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Yes, absolutely. So it was actually May 30th when I had initially went outside. And the reason why I went out was because of everything that we were seeing on the news. And George Floyd isn't the first man that said he couldn't breathe. And it was very triggering for a lot of New York organizers and activists who were on the ground during the case of Eric Garner. And he also said, I can't breathe. And so for us, it was really important to stand in solidarity with Minneapolis and center the message of the movement, because what we've seen a lot of times when Black men and Black women and Black children die at the hands of police, immediately there is this narrative that's painted that seeks to criminalize and demonize them. And so it was important for us to make sure that we were centering, you know, the humanity and the urgency of standing with the George Floyd family, but also standing with the protesters out in Minneapolis. And so we came together and organized in New York City, and we posted a flyer at 12 p.m. on May 31st because I was out the day before and there wasn't an organized protest taking place and folks were looking for something that they could centrally get behind. And so we posted the flyer at 12 p.m. on May 31st, which was also the 99th anniversary of the burning of Black Wall Street. And by 8 p.m. that night, we had led the largest nonviolent protest to take place in New York City that day. And after that, we were just on the ground ever since organizing and mobilizing. We launched our policy platform, which is actually going to be introduced to the New York State Assembly this year. We've spoken with the March on Washington, and we've done a bunch of things on the national and local level to really just continue to center and amplify the message of the movement.
Obviously, I know you certainly leverage social media to get your message heard and mobilize people. And as we all know, it's a wonderful tool, but like it or not, attention spans can be short. How do you use technology and social media to continually capture people's attention and really their longer term commitment?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because I remember from day one when we were out on the ground, we were like, the news cycle is going to change and we need to make sure that we have the resources to do this work when the cameras turn off. And so we spent a lot of our time being intentional about when we were being interviewed, what were we saying? When we were putting out content on social media, what was the call to action? It was really important for us to have a very clear and defined one. And so I remember that there was this video that went viral and Anderson Cooper's team got a hold of me and we did a sit down interview this past summer. And one of the things that we talked about was the importance of trusting Black women leadership, understanding the nuances of this movement and what allyship really means. And that looks like sustainable support. And so we had a call to action for any folks who were gatekeepers to brands or organizations or sustainable funding to make sure that that pipeline was reaching young organizers on the front lines. We had a call to action within the movement of systemic policy change. So it was really important for us to just make sure that as we were creating infographics, we were giving people the resources on who to follow. As we were in media interviews, we were very clear about who to follow, as well as where you can get information about what next steps looks like. And that's how we continue to just center the message. And that has been a common thread throughout all of the interviews that I've had and all of the conversations that I've been a part of.
So obviously you've gone against the 24-hour news cycle and really created this staying power for the movement. Can you describe the work that you and your colleagues have done to really maintain that momentum, and then talk about that, some of that real lasting change that you were alluding to earlier, about legislation and your policy platform that you introduced as well.
Yeah, so I would say that it's twofold. I think that the staying power comes from one, being intentional about what the world sees. One of the biggest things that we said this past summer leading up to even the elections and now is that the world is watching. What do we want to tell them and what do we want to show them? And so there was an intentionality there of being clear on what that was. And then I would say, as far as the behind the scenes, that looks like continuing to support young organizers in New York City. One of our youngest organizers during the summer was 17 years old. She was supposed to be graduating the day that we led our Juneteenth protest. And actually after the Juneteenth protest that took place in New York, Juneteenth became a state holiday. And so it was really important for us to continue to do that work, to continue to show up for the work, and just make sure that we were centering the message. And then on the policy platform side, from this past summer, we had a lot of folks who had reached out to us and said, how can we help? How can we get involved in the movement? And one of the biggest things that we said was that we need to make sure that we are creating systemic change. And so we develop our Five to Freedom policy platform. We have a youth commission that we essentially designed with the help of folks who had done it previously in Philadelphia and LA. And so we are introducing that this year to New York City. And then we also have a policy focused on getting cops out of classrooms and qualified immunity. And so really just thinking about, based on where we are right now within the movement, what are some immediate changes? And then what are some of the long-term changes? What a lot of people don't know is that this past summer, before Kamala Harris was even named VP, she had a sit down with some of the lead organizers in the country. And we talked about a lot of these things. And so for us, it's really important to make sure that even on a local level, that we are making sure that there's that parallel that's happening on a national scale as well, and holding this current administration accountable to a lot of the promises that were made, because we know that Black women showed up at the ballot. We know that young people showed up at the ballot. And that was because of what happened this past summer in bringing folks outside through the movement, because even data shows that before the George Floyd protest, there was actually a plateau in voter registration. And after the protests, there was an increase. And a lot of that was because of the on-the-ground organizing that was happening to get folks registered to vote. In addition to protesting, we were also doing voter mobilization. We were training young people across the country digitally how to organize voter registration drives in their communities, how to get folks to the ballot, how to organize nonviolent protests in their communities as well. And so there was a lot of behind-the-scenes work that people don't know that took place to make everything that has happen. And it wasn't just Freedom March, right? It was young people across this country, and it was organizers across this country. And so we have done our part, but there's still so much that needs to be done.
What is your hope that this administration will usher in terms of change? Are there certain policies that you've been pushing?
So my hope for this administration, I would say that there's a lot of policies that we are pushing, I would say the biggest one is police accountability. I would say the second one is funding. I think it's really important for us to take a look at the prison industrial complex and see the ways in which we can start defunding, right, the systems that ultimately contribute to the criminalization of Black and Brown communities, and think about ways of resourcing through mental health resources and more education and funding in those areas. And so what we are paying attention to and what we have been paying attention to is the budget, is the allocation of resources, is how are we going about being intentional about standing in solidarity, not just through lip service, but through the very real tangible necessities that we need within our communities. And then I would also say the really big one that'll be coming up is around qualified immunity and this idea of, as public servants, which police officers are, because it is tax dollars that pay, right, for their budget, how are we making sure that in that same way that they are held accountable to the people? And how do we make sure that they do their jobs in a way that is reflective of what the people want. And so creating, right, the space for that and for people to feel as though they are not subservient to the various systems that should be beholden to them. And so there is a lot that needs to be done in that space, but we are pushing and we are working. And I would say that one of the biggest things that you can do is just stay informed on what's happening on a local level, especially in New York City. The mayoral races is coming up. We're actually holding a mayoral forum in March for a lot of the candidates that are running to have conversations around these very same things, around what is your agenda for creating systemic change in the space of criminal justice reform, but also education and housing and everything else that intersects when we talk about race in America and the history of that.
As you talk to young people, do you think that there's that understanding that the fight's just begun? A lot of times I think, you know, obviously once you get maybe a candidate that you wanted into public office, it's like, okay, great. But how do you show young people that we've got to do the hard work now of holding them accountable, but also being their allies? Because one of the things that I certainly know, having worked in government, is that you need an external constituency to be pushing you in the right direction. You need an external constituency to providing pressure that you can point to those who maybe are against those ideas. So how are you working with young people to get them to really recognize that, you know, the work has just begun?
Yeah, I think that young people already know that the work has just begun. I think the question is, how are we showing up for young people? One of the biggest things that we've seen this past year is that, you know, a lot of people say young people are the future, or young people are the future, but in reality, young people are the present. And one of the things that you said earlier, at least that resonates with me, is the fact that I am just an example of what happens when you give a young Black girl at a very early age the resources and the tools to understand, right, what does sustainable change look like and how you can be a part of that. But the passion is there, right? It's just the resources that oftentimes aren't. And so for me, when I think about what does it look like to continue to engage young people, that's why it's so important to share stories like Freedom March NYC, to show that ordinary people can do extraordinary things when they come together, when you have a friendship that evolves into purpose and service, and understanding that when there's a need, there are opportunities to answer that need in the world. And so for me, I think that when I think about engaging with young people, which is really our demographic, because we are a youth-led civil rights organization, it's to really hear what young people are talking about and how can we resource them to be able to do the work that they're passionate about, and not necessarily tell them what they need, but rather give them what they need. And that's also very resonant with a lot of what I've talked about over these past few months. You know, a lot of times we would get into these interviews, or we would get on these calls with different organizations or leaders who are like, you know, tell us, like, what can we do to support Freedom March? And we will literally have a three-step outline, and then they'll respond saying, well, what about this? And we've already made it so clear what we need, right? And so I think that the folks who are closest to the issue oftentimes have the solutions. It's just whether or not we're going to give them the megaphone to be very clear about what that is.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you and a fellow student started Women Everywhere Believe, and this was obviously prior to Freedom March NYC. And this was inspired by the idea of mentoring and the lessons you'd wanted to have learned at a younger age to really build a leadership pipeline for women of color. Can you talk about the genesis of the organization and the ways you hope its ethos really expands to cascade impact for many generations to come?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I started We Believe while I was a student at Columbia University with my sweet mate at the time, who is now one of my closest friends, Akwia Obeng-Akrofi. And we came together to start We Believe because as Black women on Columbia's campus, we realized that first and foremost, there wasn't enough of us. And two, that oftentimes when you look at the pathways to being able to attain higher education and the resources that are needed when you think about social and economic mobility, that a lot of times it's just not present in the communities where we come from. And so we created We Believe to be a pipeline for leadership opportunities for young girls and women of color. And so we piloted a program in Harlem, which of course the Vital Voices supported. I was the grantee at the time, and that blossomed into us then expanding because so many other young women on their campuses saw the work that we were doing. It was like, how can we get involved? And so we expanded and developed a chapter system where we had chapters essentially nationwide. And so before the pandemic, actually, we were across 8 states and 20 plus universities and had just expanded to a chapter in India. And we were on tour March, because March was Women's History Month when New York shut down. We were in our first week of a tour that we were actually doing in New York City schools. We were providing workshops and panels to young girls in schools throughout New York. And then all of that to say, of course, with the pandemic and the lockdown, we had to postpone the tour. And so we're getting ready to launch that back up actually this year. But all of that to say that we believe in the incredible work that we were able to do over the past few years, from being able to work with Tarana Burke, the creator of the Me Too movement, to being able to honor so many incredible women leaders and create spaces for women and girls to understand their leadership potential, but also to lead and show up as their most authentic selves, is definitely the heart of my activism and has informed so much of the decisions that I've even made in my work on the front lines of how I show up for Black women, on how I center Black women and girls, and how I'm intentional about what my leadership even looks like, because it has to be authentic and reflective of the same exact things that I've taught through We Believe. And so if that means saying no to brand deals, then I do that all the time. If that means saying no to, you know, an opportunity because it may not necessarily align with the type of leader that I have understood is the best version of myself, then I am perfectly fine with that. And so I hope I inspire other young girls to go out there and be their most authentic and true selves. And I'm excited for the next chapter of We Believe to continue to do the work and think through, obviously, in the midst of COVID-19 and a global pandemic, how we can show up.
So your generation of young women, do you think that you lead differently? And what difference would you say that you are bringing to the world?
Yeah, so I would definitely say that we are unapologetic. I have a lot of friends in the organizing or social impact space, and we all have that similar theme of we are not going to shrink ourselves for anybody, and we are going to show up in the many facets in which we exist. We are not going to fit into a box. We are going to post on social media the most thought-provoking content and then also post our pictures of us doing a girls' night out. And I think that that's important for us to show that duality. I think it's important for us to show that we are human too. I think especially on social media where there's this idea of perfection, it's really important for this generation, generations moving forward, who aren't going to necessarily exist in a world where social media never existed, right? They're going to grow up in the age of everything always being there and eyes always watching. And so I think that it's really important that we give each other grace to learn, to grow. And then the last thing I would say is that, you know, really defying respectability politics has been at the core of a lot of our work within the activism space. The history of the civil rights movement, there were a lot of Black men who were the figures and who were at the forefront. And I think now we're seeing more visibly Black women, but it's not because Black women didn't exist before in the movement, because there was the Shirley Chisholms, there was Ida B. Wells, right? There was Fannie Lou Hamer. There were all of these incredible Black women. But the truth is, because of the history, right, of gender inequality and sexism within our country, the ways that Black women's bodies have been policed in the movement, and the way that Black women have been forced to essentially take the back room when company comes, it was really important for us to show that, no, we are here and we're going to be visible, and we are going to be very clear that when Black women show up, we show up for everybody, and we show up to make sure that this work is done in an authentic way. And so just continuing to do that and continuing to be true to who we are has been really critical to the work.
Chelsea, one last question for you. What is your power and how do you use it to empower?
That is a really good one. So I would say that my power is, I have like twofold, but I'll say one that probably sticks with me the most. One of the biggest things that I always say is that leadership isn't what you will do in the place of comfort, but what you will do in the place of uncertainty. And so I would say that my power is stepping out into the unknown and being confident enough to know that something great will come out of that. And I think that throughout my entire life, there have been many times where, you know, I have thought about, okay, what is the safest option to take? And then thinking again, like, even though it's perhaps the safest option, is this the option that really speaks to me? Is this the path that really allows me to impact the most people, and to think about what my legacy is going to be and what do I want to leave in the world? And so with that, I oftentimes choose the path less taken. And I'm grateful for that, because I think that this journey of social justice and my activism and becoming has really been grounded in that sense of stepping out into the unknown. And so I will continue to do that for the rest of my life and see what happens. So I guess stay tuned.
Chelsea, it's been such a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you so much for all you do and making the time to give us a window into your world and what you've been thinking about. And I'm sitting here in awe of all you've done. So we're thrilled to have you as part of the Vital Voices family network, and definitely looking forward to all of what we know you will do next.
Thank you. And it's definitely been a pleasure. Vital Voices at this point, I think, has known me for basically a third of my life. So it's always great to kind of come back to where a lot of it started.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of the Vital Voices podcast. If you'd like to support our work with women leaders who use their power to empower others, you can donate to Vital Voices on our website at vitalvoices.org, or you can text VITAL to 41444. That's VITAL to 41444. See you next week.